Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
If you think this has a happy ending, you haven't been paying attention.
Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. As always, I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. So this is probably fairly predictable to you, but I absolutely love Game of Thrones, both the TV series and the books. If you're telling me that we can have a gritty, quasi-realistic medieval setting with knights and backstabbing politics and, oh hell yeah, dragons, I'm in. So now, how is all that relevant to us here on Tides of History? You might be asking that question. Well, the author of the book series, George R.R. Martin, very explicitly drew on the late Middle Ages for inspiration, especially the Wars of the Roses. Now, in the process of doing that, Martin introduced a bunch of themes to his world that resonate really strongly with the actual history of that period. Since we've just spent a whole bunch of time on that here on Tides, I wanted to address it specifically. So to help me do that, I've got a great guest here in the studio today. He's a dear friend of mine. He enjoys both Game of Thrones and history, which makes him the perfect person to discuss this topic with. He has worked on some shows you'd recognize. Albro Lundy, thank you so much for joining me.
So happy to be here.
So before we dig in, two quick notes. First, this is mostly going to be about the TV series rather than the books. And second, there are going to be spoilers here. Lots of spoilers. So if you haven't watched up to the most recent episodes, this might not be for you. You should also watch up to the most recent episodes because it's real good.
Yeah, if someone isn't caught up and they're listening to a Game of Thrones like history podcast crossover, I want to meet you. What is going on in your brain? Thrones is now, it's kind of funny, like as I get busier, I throw out more and more things that I used to keep up with, like a lot of comedies fall by the wayside because they don't feel, they don't create as much of a big emotional connection. And as such, they're like candy. And when you're only eating one meal a day, like it can't be a Baby Ruth. and so the, like Game of Thrones is just now like one of the staples of what I'm looking forward to and thinking about, which is crazy, because it's, I mean, like, if you were one of those people reading a Song of Fire and Ice, like any high fantasy book, 15 years ago, thinking that it would be the biggest thing on the planet.
Especially this one.
Yeah, it's nuts. It's crazy that it is as big as it is. But I think that it speaks to how resonant so many of the themes in it are. Like, it has a lot to say about stuff that will always be relevant.
Hey, it's Patrick, and I've got some really exciting news. You can now listen to our entire back catalog completely ad-free, exclusively, on Stitcher Premium. If you enjoyed our episodes on the Black Death, on chivalry, on peasants, that great interview we did with friend of the show Dan Jones on the Knights Templar, you can come back to that completely ad-free anytime you want. In addition to our archive, you can also listen to every new episode ad-free, as well as tons of other ad-free Wondery shows like Dirty John, Dr. Death, and American Innovations. Plus, with Stitcher Premium, you'll get access to hundreds of hours of original content, audio documentaries, and exclusive bonus episodes from some of your other favorite podcasts. You can sign up now for a free month of Stitcher Premium by going to stitcherpremium.com/Wondery and using the promo code Wondery. Then, once you're signed up, just download the Stitcher app for iOS or Android and start listening. That's stitcherpremium.com/Wondery and promo code Wondery. Yeah, I think it coming up in an age where politics has become fodder for mass consumption has helped make it more relevant than it would have been otherwise.
Right. I think, yeah, that's one of the things about talking about this show in the context of history that is so interesting to me, because there's so many historical parallels that you can draw because the trappings are so similar. But there's also stuff that is extremely relevant even today. Like, you see these archetypes show up. They just have different names. Like, history is cyclical. Like, it's just one of those things that the fundamental human experience is going to paint it, and then the technology is going to influence a little bit. But, like, we tell the same stories a lot, right? Like, similar characters, similar themes.
Yeah, it's a show that, and a book series that hits on, I'm glad you mentioned this, on themes. Themes that recur over and over again. They're themes that really central to the politics of the late Middle Ages. I think that's a direct result of its lineage, but also Martin's own concerns. You know, themes are an expression of the author's moral vision of the world, right? Like, that's where the author lays out what he thinks it's about or what she thinks it's about and what what is important to them. And so the themes of Game of Thrones come back to over and over and over again. But I want to start with the biggest one, and it's legitimacy. What gives somebody the right to rule?
Thrones has a really, I mean, one of the things that is so funky about the political analysis that goes on in Game of Thrones is that divinity is real. There's a race of humans who can actually control dragons, at which point, like, if that is a variable that can exist in your geopolitical spectrum, then suddenly, like, having the god king of Egypt doesn't seem so crazy anymore, right? Like, there are systems of government that, like, well, I mean, if that guy can control fire, maybe he should be in charge? Like, who's going to stop him? Our entire police force is going to be focused on stopping the one fire guy? Like, maybe if we put him in charge. It's interesting. So much of Thrones it tries to be about sort of like family ties and blood lineage. But you get a whole smorgasbord of ways that people have access to ways that people get in the room. Right. So I think it's actually pretty interesting because Game of Thrones has this additional subset of characters beyond the sort of main chess pieces on the board. So you've got like these royal families, like the Starks and the Targaryens and the Lannisters. And they're all playing a very predictable game of hungry, hungry hippos. But there's other people that have managed to sort of crack their way into the discussion by nature of either their pragmatism or like their experience and wisdom translating to actual sort of success or tangible result. So there's a realism there, right? You know, I think Martin, I have so much to say about this, but like, where do you see legitimacy and authority showing up in the show, and how does that measure up with regards to the historical developments of those things?
Okay, so I think the legitimacy and authority are like the two central concerns of this show. Like, what gives somebody the right to rule? What gives somebody the right to exercise power? How do they exercise power? To what end? How does morality fit into that, if at all? Right. Those are kind of the central questions that the show asks of the people who have that kind of power and authority. Like, what claims are they making? What is the basis for those claims? And are those claims right? And the way that the show answers those questions says a lot about how Martin and the writers of the TV show view the world.
Right. That's the thing, is that like if the question is sort of like blanket, how does legitimacy work in this world? There's a whole bunch of actual sort of like canony answers. But there's an editorializing that does come through, I think, that is it's pretty clear. There's all these characters, like, I mean, the main two at this point, right? Like, if we're talking about where the show is, like, John and Danny are both so tired all the time because John hates being the guy. Like, he was never meant for this. He was born a bastard. And Danny keeps getting introduced by the god running this universe to all these moral quandaries with really hard answers. Like, she's got to make some insane compromises in order to make everything work. And so the two of them are, in theory, the right kind of leader you want, right? Like, they're the person that understands the leader is supposed to help someone, and they also understand how heavy that charge is because helping people is hard. But it's so interesting because in terms of a sort of moralizing aspect, like, they have a right to rule because they're good people, right? Because they're smart, because they help everyone, because they understand what they're supposed to be doing. But they're also both from the same royal family. Like, it is this really brutal message that runs through the show of, like, if you're up that high, you probably got a leg up, right?
There are blood claims involved. Like, if we separate out the various kinds of claims that are made to authority and legitimacy in this show, you start with lineage, with bloodline. Who's your father? Who's your mother? How does that trickle down to you, the political actor? Then there's the idea of earning your place. There's the idea of merit playing into your legitimacy and your claim to rule. And the argument that kind of emerges over the course of the show is that you have to do all of those things. You can't just have the right name, and you can't just have risen by your own merit. That both of those paths lead somewhere. That if you want people to follow you, you have to have a great name, and you have to have proven it. and that the combination of those two things is what gives you the right to rule.
Well, it's interesting because I think a real juicy story direction would be for someone like a Varys or a Tyrion to actually be in that position of power. Like, one of my friends very cynically once remarked that it's so funny how all the best singers also happen to be attractive. Like, it's weird how that works out. It's also weird how, like, all of the best leaders happen to be cut from this particular marble, right? John and Danny, if anything, have that elusive electability that everyone likes to talk about leading up to an election. But if Game of Thrones truly, like, if they're trying to break from giving us this sort of, like, bleak analysis that, like, yeah, rich kids have it easier, I think it would be intriguing to see someone actually wrest power away from them or slide into it on true merit. Because so far, if you're looking at, like, achievement and wisdom as markers that give you access, every single person who has gotten that point is still a vizier. Like, there are these advisors who have all have tragic backstories. And so they're good advisors because their experience with the world makes them grounded and makes them understand how things work in a way that, like, John and Danny and everyone can't. But, like, they don't get to ultimately make the big decisions. Like, it is only by virtue of the fact that they can talk pretty that they're there. And even then, that's all that they can do.
Well, and who's the one character who really tries to rise from essentially nothing all the way up to the top? It's Peter Baelish. It's Littlefinger. And how does Littlefinger die?
Oh, I wish he was uglier, because then I'd be able to root for him, you know? Like, he's, ugh.
Well, he gives this great speech at some point about how chaos is not a pit. It's a ladder.
It's a ladder to climb,
and it's one of the really iconic scenes in Game of Thrones is him talking about how you can rise up from nothing. And in the end, though, he can't. He plays the cards that he has as well as anybody possibly can. But at the end of the day, in the world of Game of Thrones, there are some ambitions that are too much for a person who starts where he started to try to reach.
Yeah, even like the Starks are, I think, maybe the most sort of exterior group that have a chance at influencing this grand machine. And even then, if they're not royalty, they're still, like, really, really noble. Like, their dad is a grocery store mogul in Wisconsin. Like, they're doing great, right? Like, they're not really stressed about how their lineage is going to affect their own survival.
They're one of the great lineages, which says a lot about the world itself, that, like, the real contenders are all coming from this absolute upper crust of the elite. Right there, who's made claims on being a king over the course of this show? We have Robert Baratheon. So he starts out as the king. He's the head of one of the great families of the realm. You have the Lannisters, who are one of the great families of the realm. You have the Starks, who are one of the great families of the realm. You have the brothers of Robert Baratheon, who are members of one of the great families. You have the Kings of the Iron Islands, one of the great families, right? Like, these are not people who are starting off from obscurity and making their way to becoming king. Even Jon Snow, the guy that by this point is very clearly our, like, stereotypical fantasy hero, is still a member of a great house.
It would give the show and the story a lot of juice if one of the big bad guys was more relatable. I think right now we're at a point where every single baddie left is this great, clear evil that is dominated by id, right? They're like this pure hunger. Like, Cersei is this horrible scheming heiress, and the walkers are this gigantic frozen zombie hive mind up north. And I would love it if one of the characters who had a more hunger-based mentality was doing it because they understand the reality, because they experience the hardship within it. Like, it'd be really cool to get that villain who came up from the streets, you know, like, born to a lower status and see them really triumph. But I guess that is, like, one of the lessons of this show. It's this, like, just brutal reality that you're kind of locked into your station unless you're really crafty, right?
Which is a direct parallel with the politics of the late Middle Ages, right? Like, you have there was a lot of upheaval and there were a lot of political breakdowns in the late Middle Ages.
Well, so that's one of the questions I have for you. I'm always so curious about what perception I have of history compared to what the reality is. The earlier seasons of Game of Thrones are a gigantic
maze of left turns because there's so many players in the game that you can knock a few over, and a few of them have gotten enough screen time that it really hurts when they go away, but there's still a lot of sort of like established people waiting left. But we're naturally heading towards a close now where like the main characters can't die, like there's some people wearing plot armor, like you kind of know who the final actors look like. In history, how many periods of high ruling turnover do we actually hear about? Because I was thinking about that and I was like, that makes for awesome TV, but really boring history, right? Like nobody cares about the 50 years at the end of Rome where it was just all Vandals taking turns murking each other. Like it's like a new warlord's in charge every week. Like that doesn't make for good narrative. And so it probably doesn't make for good history.
No one should feel unsafe at home, period. Even if the attacker happens to be Queen Daenerys Targaryen and her army of Unsullied and dragons and Dothraki, fear has no place in a place like home. That has been SimpliSafe's mission from day one. SimpliSafe blankets your whole home with protection. Around-the-clock monitoring makes sure police are on the way when you need them. No ravaging war bands here. The security sensors are tiny, blending in with your home so you won't notice them. The Verge calls SimpliSafe, quote, the best home security, and it's a Wirecutter top pick. As more than 3 million SimpliSafe customers already know, it feels good to fear less. So protect your home today. You'll get free shipping on any system order. Just visit simplisafe.com/tides. That's simplisafe.com/tides to protect your home and family today. simplisafe.com/tides.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/business.
Well, so this is one of the period that Martin's drawing on is very explicitly like the late Middle Ages and the Wars of the Roses. And one of the things that you see in the Wars of the Roses is like a tremendous amount of turnover of the high nobility, of the people who are playing the Game of Thrones in England in the second half of the 15th century. You get 60-70% of them die in this. So you get a ton of turnover. And the guy who's left with the claim to the throne at the end is Henry Tudor, who has barely a drop of English royal blood in his veins. He's the grandson of a French princess. But in terms of actual English royal blood, you've got to go back like seven generations to find a bit from a minor son. And even then through an illegitimate line.
Are there any clear standout characters in this period who really did sort of hack their way upwards? Like how often is a rags to riches? And I guess if you replace riches with power, like how often does that story happen?
Okay, so I think there is only one really good example of that, and it's a Hungarian guy named John Hunyadi, who starts off as kind of a minor like border noble. And through by hook and by crook, in a context of instability within the Kingdom of Hungary, manages to work his way up to the point where he's the regent and his son, Matthias Corvinus, becomes king of Hungary. But so he doesn't get to do it. John Hunyadi himself does not get to be king, but his son does. But that's one of the very, very few examples of this. Like the people who are getting promoted to the top in this period are already members of the nobility. Or members of the high nobility, like the people who are playing the game, who are making claims to rights, because late medieval politics is fundamentally about claims to rights.
Okay, so this Hungarian king worked his butt off to finally get there, and then it's his kid who gets to be in charge of the whole thing after he like does he die or does he stick around to watch his kid take improv classes? Like how does this work?
I'm trying to remember. I think he's dead by that point, but Hungarian monarchy was elective.
Uh-huh.
So the nobles got together and they decided who the king was going to be. And so
what other secret democracies did I not know about from the Middle Ages?
But this is an interesting thing. Like I think there's an unfortunate misconception that the late Middle Ages or the Middle Ages in general were like totally absolutist, and they weren't. And I think it's a misconception even like early modern politics when you hit the height of actual absolutism. you still have people who have to buy in. Like, you still have political constituencies that have to agree to be ruled. Like, you have to, the absolutist monarch still has to offer actors within the political system something. You can't just tell people what to do all the time and they automatically do it.
I'm very curious about that, because one of the things that Thrones does is every once in a while we'll check in on the common man, and the common man is always getting run over by a truck. Like, just the show does not treat the peasants well. And we've seen the conversations in the opulent gardens that have led to the circumstances that cause these people's lives to materially get worse. Is there any historical example during this period where your right to rule was contingent upon, like, if you actually made people's lives better?
Okay, that's actually a great question, because it's one of the central concerns in the Wars of the Roses, actually, is the idea of what a king is supposed to do. Like, there's a joke here. I mean, it sounds kind of jokey in one way, where you're like, oh, you know, the king is supposed to do king things. But, like, the things the king did were he was supposed to defend the realm, and he was supposed to provide justice. He was supposed to provide, like, justice as a government service, that you send out people to hear cases and to deliver the raw kind of justice that only the king could provide. Only the king could be an impartial arbiter of disputes within his kingdom.
Like, well, so that sounds a little bit like law enforcement. One of the things, like, now in like our modern elections, I'll just use like the U.S. political system as my example. The economy is a huge influencing factor when we pick who our government is, right? That's something that we know now, that, like, governments don't have a crazy amount of control over. And I have to imagine that sort of, like, vaguely nebulous relationship echoes in the past. Could, if there wasn't enough food, did kings get deposed? Like, did they find out about it, or were they mostly, like, I'm not assuming that everyone's Versailles, right? But there have to, like, if people aren't getting enough food, is that something that made its way to the king and subsequently to our opinion of them hundreds of years later?
Not exactly, but the lowest levels of the peasantry were not really political actors. So when you talk about what's the constituency for government, you're talking about a broad noble class and then other kind of collective groups that could act in concert, right? So, like, towns are a big political actor. Towns have a political voice. Urban elites have a political voice. Some members of the upper peasantry kind of have a voice, but the kinds of people who are starving very rarely do. And that's something that Game of Thrones gets absolutely right about the politics of its world, and it could draw exactly from the politics of, well, frankly, our world too, is that the poorest do not have any political they are not a political constituency that anybody cares about.
Right. It is interesting how the populist movements, as portrayed by Game of Thrones, like the rulers who have some real public swing behind them, are still nobility. But I guess, yeah, that's the message that you get as a result of consuming this narrative, right?
Yeah, that this is a story about leaders and leadership, and what makes for leaders in this particular world is at least one part lineage. Like, you got to earn it. You know, there's a great line where I think Varys is often the mouthpiece for kind of the deep thematic elements of the show or the books, like whether it's Martin putting the words in there or whether it's the show's writers. He says,
"Any fool with a bit of luck can find himself born into power. But earning it for yourself, that takes work."
Saying the person who still probably has the right bloodline, who has access to power in the first place, like, you still, you're not just handed it, you know, you still have to go about proving that you deserve to wield it. And, like, that's kind of the moral vision for what power looks like in that.
I am really curious how much in history everyone hated the heirs, because, like, nobody likes the boss's kid, right? And this is the most extreme example of that. Like, if you like the king or don't like the king, the fact that his kid automatically gets control feels like something that would engender a pretty quick degree of animosity.
So what's funny is that heirs were almost always, in this period, the center of resistance to the king. Their households were very often, either they were their father's right hand and were always acting directly in concert with them, or they were a center of resistance. There was no real in-between. Because if you're looking for an alternative to the current king, where do you go but to the person who has the next best claim? It's the king's son. So, like, Louis XI of France, who's one of my very favorite kings of the late Middle Ages, is a fascinating guy. They called him the universal spider because he was constantly weaving a diplomatic web around his opponents and constantly kind of them pulling them deeper and deeper and deeper until eventually they got caught and they got killed. That was what Louis XI did. But as heir to the throne, Louis's father, Charles VII, hated him, absolutely despised him, hated him. Louis spent like the last 3 or 4 years of his father's reign in exile because his father did not like him so much. And as a 16-year-old, Louis tried his first rebellion against his father. So if you're a disaffected prince and you're looking for somebody to you're not happy with the king and you're looking for somebody to represent your interests, the heir to the throne is your best option because he's got a claim, right? He can just say, my father's had his day. Time for me to be the king.
Right. So in the same way that like every election is a change election, all of these princes knew to array themselves in opposition to the king because that's how you gain support in your claim to power.
Well, the idea was that their claim to power was legitimate in the first place, right? Like that all of medieval politics is about claims to rights. It's about staking out a claim and then trying to enforce it. Like that's where all conflict in medieval politics came from.
I have another question for you, which is so TV kind of has rules, right, that start to kick in as you head towards an end game. You start to figure out like who is not supposed to die or who, if they do die, is going like what that's going to mean. Right. But humans are narratively minded creatures anyways. Right. So if we're going to write stories about historical time periods, we should probably be aware of what filters upwards. And I'm curious if the degree to which what filters upwards, particularly in the period of the War of the Roses, where you've got like people actually writing about it, are there any big misconceptions that managed to sort of like break into the general understanding of things because it made for a better tale, right?
The basic structure of the story. Right. And this is where I think you get a really nice parallel with Game of Thrones, and that the basic story of the Wars of the Roses that they tell is that you have two houses, York and Lancaster, fighting for control of the English throne. That's a very attractive, very simple story. It's the one that came to popularity in like first in the 16th century as a result of Tudor propaganda, the house that comes out on top of the Wars of the Roses. It's a Tudor story and it filters through into the rest of the perception of the period for hundreds of years afterwards. Now, as it turns out, that's not the story at all. Like you can't even talk about like Yorkist and Lancastrian factions in the Wars of the Roses until like a decade in. You don't like it doesn't make sense. It's not really the right framework for it. Even afterward, like people are changing sides all the time. There are multiple players. Foreign kings are involved, like supporting first one side and then another. Power players switch sides at really important moments, like key members of the constituencies of each side. At the end, there's nothing Yorkist or Lancastrian about really either side, aside from some very distant claims and a few retainers who have managed to survive. Like that's the wrong way of looking at it. The Wars of the Roses is really a multipolar conflict between a whole bunch of different parties, only some of whom were even English. So what you get in Game of Thrones is a multi-sided conflict, right? It's the War of the Five Kings is the central early conflict in Game of Thrones. And what it captures is precisely how complicated and convoluted and weird it is when you have an ongoing civil war with so many different players, each of whom has a multiplicity of connections to the other players involved.
So one of the things that I like about the middle portion of Game of Thrones, because there's so much turnover, is that the rivals treat each other like actual rivals, right? And that results in a lot of very sort of like quiet bloodshed off to the side. With a period as tumultuous as this, is there a good deal of people getting like exiled or quietly stabbed in the back that like doesn't make it into the popular understanding of what happened? Like, or did people have to actually play a little bit nicer in this period?
So there were tons of exiles. exile was a thing that people did all the time, usually just trying to go and bide their time before they could eventually plot their return. But there were tons of exiles, and there were also tons of executions. And one of the things that I like about Game of Thrones as the show goes on is that it gets personal. And I think one of the most poignant episodes in the Wars of the Roses involves this is like 6 or 7 years in, the son of the Duke of York, a guy named Edmund, the Earl of Rutland. He's 17 years old. He's running for safety after a battle in which his father has gotten captured. He almost makes it to Sanctuary, almost makes it to the safety of a church. And one of the people on the other side, on the Lancastrian side, grabs him, pulls out a dagger, stabs him through the heart and says, "Your father did this to mine." And that's pure revenge. That's pure bloody revenge. So what had been a political conflict, and these people were just, they were just players. They were after what they were after. After years and years and years of ongoing conflict, becomes personal. Questions of who gets to rule becomes a thing where you're stabbing each other with a dagger on a bridge.
Well, and does any of that stuff make it get litigated in the court of public opinion? Like, were you allowed to have an opinion on the fact that someone got stabbed in a dark hallway? Like,
what happens eventually is that people get sick of it. Like, and what they want is somebody who can do the job a king is supposed to do. Like, what people wanted was they wanted stability and they wanted law and order, right? They wanted their property rights to be protected. They wanted there to be royal justice for them to turn to. And they would prefer it were there not marauding armies going through their territory on a fairly regular basis. So eventually, if somebody comes along who can just say, okay, I've got a good enough claim on the throne, you can call me legitimate, I'm going to do the job of a king and do it right, then we're in good shape, and people would buy into that. That's what happens with Edward IV, who is one of the most direct carryovers from the Wars of the Roses to Game of Thrones. He is the model for Robert Baratheon, the fat king at the beginning of Game of Thrones who gets gored to death by a boar and whose death kind of sets off this whole chain of events. Edward IV of England took the throne as a tall, strapping, handsome 18-year-old and drank and ate himself into obesity and an early grave. And his death kicked off Richard III's usurpation, where he kills the princes in the Tower, and eventually that's who Henry Tudor kills to take the throne of England. So that's a direct carryover, but basically, by the time Edward IV took the throne, people were just sick of war, and they're like, okay, you're good enough, you seem to be good at this, you won your crown on a battlefield, great, okay, we'll roll with you.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Takeoff 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
The only exercise that Edward IV seems to have gotten towards the end of his life was in a bedroom. He was a prolific lover, which is another thing that that George R.R. Martin takes over for Robert Baratheon. Edward IV loved a roll in the hay, as they say.
It feels like one of the only potential job perks back then, right? Like, you can't pay more money for faster internet back then. It's mostly like you get access to food and comfort and...
What is it, Mel Brooks says?
It's
good to be the king.
Like, yeah. But
Edward IV wasn't even the most prolific one of the age. The most prolific one was a guy named Duke Philip the Good of Burgundy, who had Philip the Good. But he had between 10 and 30 illegitimate children.
Wow.
That's a lot. That's a lot of illegitimate children. He also often did not get out of bed before noon, and those two things were probably connected.
Did those kids ever hang out with each other?
Yeah, regularly. The guy who was called like the great bastard or the grand bastard of Burgundy, whose name was Anthony, who was like the most trusted associate. And the grand bastard of Burgundy almost killed the king of France on a battlefield in 1465. He lanced his horse, but almost took out Louis XI. And but yeah, no, they were all deeply involved. And Philip the Good found, like, he found good marriages for them. A bunch of them became bishops. Like, it's nice to have your half brothers as bishops.
What does a bishop get to do?
Bishop gets to do a lot of things, man.
Being a bastard sounds like it gets a bad rap in both Thrones and history, but then you find out that, like, no, they get to be bishops. Like, they get to rule Winterfell, apparently.
If you're the bastard of somebody who's very well off in this period, generally speaking, you're going to be born to somebody who is, like, you're not going to be born to a commoner. It's usually going to be some member of the nobility. So you're going, and your parent is usually obligated, as long as they kind of acknowledge that you are their offspring, is going to be obligated to find something for you. And if you're the Grand Duke of, if you're the Duke of Burgundy or the King of England, you can find something for him. Henry VIII had an illegitimate son, and he had great plans for that little guy until he died.
What were those plans?
I think he was, well, so he gave him a noble title and lands. And since he had no legitimate sons at that point, it was not out of the realm of possibility that he could have eventually legitimized him, that which might have, frankly, solved a whole bunch of problems for Henry VIII. Yeah, there's a possibility. It was within the realm of possibility. Okay, so one of the things about Game of Thrones is a lot of the conflict in this show comes from established rules and institutions and people who are willing to break them down in order to get what they want, whatever that happens to be. So how does that work for a writer? If you're working within the world of a show and you've got these established rules, these things that exist in there, how does that work for you in structural terms? Like, how do you create conflict out of the kind of baseline rules of your world?
Well, it's interesting because irrational actors make for the best characters. Like, because drama stems from conflict, and conflict is something that, like, good leaders try to avoid, that means you kind of want a couple loose cannons in the mix, right? The tricky part is that television, because it is a entertainment medium, but also, like, something that needs to turn a profit, is also subject to the whims of things like shooting schedules and, like, you want less casting, you want fewer sets, right? You want to come back to certain places so you don't have to build new ones. So you have to play this delicate game of figuring out just how many irrational actors you can afford to have in your story, right? Because if you have too many people throwing too many monkey wrenches at the structure you're building, then it just dissolves into a morass. And there have been plenty of high fantasy book series, TV shows, films that had too many characters, right? That didn't have a clear sense of what was going on. You didn't have a chance to build momentum. So it's kind of like a dance. You have to build suspense and then break it. And then once you establish a pattern, you get to break that. I think one of the interesting things about Thrones is that the institutions are kind of indomitable, right? Like, so many different people have had control over the throne over the years, but, like, the throne is a constant. And is that just because there's a big stone building? Like, how much of our institutions stem from there being actual brick and mortar? Like, I'm very curious about this with regards to this historical period. Because what was the baseline thing that people assumed would always be there, right? Is it the church? Is it the crown? Is it the building that the crown lives in?
Yeah, so that's a great question, because it comes back to one of my very favorite quotes from Game of Thrones, which is from, again, our guy Varys, where he says,
"Power resides where men believe it resides. It's a trick, a shadow on the wall."
There's nothing about a throne that makes the person who sits in it powerful. Right. It's the fact that people believe that the person who sits in that chair has power. There's another one from Tywin Lannister who eventually gets shot on the privy with a crossbow. He says,
"Any man who must say I am the king is no true king."
And that's because it's about a matter of people buying in. And that's what institutions do, is they get people to buy in. They get people to believe that there is something real behind that. And the act of believing in it is what makes it real.
Are there any institutions during the War of the Roses that got shaken up or had their legitimacy genuinely questioned after the fact?
Yeah, I mean, the kingship itself, right? Like, there's, what is the king supposed to do? If you have a useless king who doesn't do anything and that lasts for an entire generation, there were people in England in 1461 who literally had spent their entire adult lives as players in a political game without seeing an adult king actively wield power. Right. They had only ever seen, because Henry V dies in 1422. His infant son, not even a year old, takes over for him. A regent council rules for him until he comes of age. And after that, he's dominated by a series of kind of powers behind the throne, right? So that's close to 40 years. You have somebody who's – you could have somebody who's well into middle age, is almost out of their prime by 1461, who has literally never seen an adult king do the things an adult king is supposed to do.
Did they have a full coronation ceremony when the infant took power?
They waited until he was like – it was in the early 1430s. It was in response to Joan of Arc. Actually, that they went through the full means of crowning him. They did it in France too, because he was also king of France at the same time. He had a claim to that. So they did one
extremely accomplished baby.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, but think about that in George R. R. Martin terms, right? Like he thinks his moral vision is that that's an absurdity. That child has done nothing to deserve to be king. He's not earned it, right? And in Martin's world, child kings don't survive. They don't last. Like, they get knocked off the throne by other more capable contenders. That's part of the moral vision of Game of Thrones. Like, in George R. R. Martin's world, there's no effective regency council that keeps a lid on things until this person comes of age. Like, it's just a disaster.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. My girlfriend and I went to the King Tut exhibit at the California Science Center recently, and I found it hilarious that maybe the most famous boy king in all of history is one that was such a loser that it was really hard to find his tomb. that is truly funny to me. Boy kings have such a bad track record. How did people ever put up with them?
Well, I think the answer is in large part they didn't. Like that's part of what precipitates the whole crisis in 1483 that Shakespeare makes so famous in Richard III that we're so kind of familiar with, like that leads to the deaths of the princes in the Tower, and then Henry Tudor invades and Richard III gets killed on the battlefield, and then they find his semi-hunchbacked corpse under a car park, like that whole thing. So in large part, the reason why Richard III panics and locks the princes in the Tower and usurps the throne is because everybody was terrified of a regency, and Richard thought that he was going to get locked out, even though he's the most important nobleman in the kingdom. He thinks that the people who are gathered around the minor heir to the throne are going to leave him out of his chosen place. And not only is that like bad for his material interests, that could also get him killed. So, like, there's a real kind of fear on Richard, Duke of Gloucester, then Richard III's part, that he's going to end up dead or cut out of what is his rightful place in the power structure.
Yeah, there's amazing fear of the crown, because if you're just in a room full of adults and you're like, all right, well, the king is dead, time to pick the new person who's in charge of us, and someone goes, I say the baby, like, everyone would look at that person with a raised eyebrow, like... All right, so what are you getting out of this, right? Like, it's just insane to me that enough people raised their hands after that proposition that they crowned the kid king.
It basically never worked. I mean, the people tried to make it work, and it's a sign, like, of how kind of stable England's political structures were, that it actually worked pretty well until Henry VI, the just feckless, ineffectual king. It actually worked pretty well until he was about 15 or 16. They managed to keep a lid on things. With only a few kind of minor flare-ups, like it's a sign of how stable and well-run the political system was and how talented the people were who were doing that they made it work for that long. But eventually, late medieval politics required an active adult to wield power as the king. They required it. Or a queen. In Spain, Isabella was perfectly capable of wielding power in her own right and absolutely did. She was not the junior partner in her relationship with Ferdinand, the King of Aragon. Like, Isabella was a high-level player in her own right, you know? But it required an active adult who could make decisions and who could survey the landscape. Even if they were the wrong decisions, it still needed somebody to make decisions, period. And it needed somebody, like... all power devolved from the king. And so nobody else could wield royal power. That's a structural constraint on politics in this period. And we see this in Game of Thrones too, like just how messed up things get toward the end of Robert Baratheon's life, because he's not making really decisions. He just wants to hunt, and he wants to have sex with anything that moves, and he wants to drink and eat. And that's all it is. He lets his hands run everything. And so the realm goes to pot without him, because royal power can't truly devolve to anybody else. Like, king's hands are supposed to be doing what the king tells them to do and wants them to do, and not just doing their own thing. And we see this theme come back over and over again over the show in the setting of King's Landing. Like, nothing good happens when the king is not the one who's making decisions, because the people who are making decisions are inevitably making decisions for themselves.
So if you have the full might of England's military in this time period, and I have two dragons, who is winning? Did they have anti-aircraft capability?
Well, you could shoot thousands of arrows up into the air, but is that going to stop a dragon? That's a good question.
Well, because I know that
depends on the dragon.
The English longbows are like an impressive piece of technology, and they allowed for a great amount of battlefield control. I just really think I'd be able to circle high enough until all the arrows were gone, and then I'd come back down again.
Just breathe fire on the arrows, too?
Yeah, arrows are flammable.
It's probably not going to work out for you. We see this. This happens in season 7 of Game of Thrones.
Oh, I haven't watched the show. sorry.
We see this. We see this battle. It's the one where Jaime Lannister takes a run at the dragon with a lance and almost gets burned to death.
Did they have comically large ballistas at that point in time?
Ballistas, not so much. Ballistas were not especially useful. They had stone throwing things because those you could use to batter down a castle wall. But this, by this period, you have cannon.
Well, everybody had cannon. Did the English know how cool they looked?
How good comically large ballista look?
Yeah, man. It's a big bow and arrow, but it's on its side.
So there were very large crossbows called arbalests, but ballista. What are you going to do with that? You might as well shoot somebody with a cannon. It's way more fun to shoot somebody with a cannon than a ballista, I feel like.
That's what I want in Game of Thrones season 8. I want people shooting at dragons with cannons. That's what I want.
Within the realm of possibility. Where are we on gunpowder as cannon in the Game of Thrones world? I can think of no better way to sum it up and end than on that note. Albro, thanks so much for coming in. It's good to see you. I don't see you enough, man.
Thank you for having me.
Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show and send us your questions at Tides History. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Leah Sutherland. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, this has been Tides of History.
Once upon a beat! Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me,
DJ Fuge,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the new kids and family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Once Upon a Beat.